Welcome to the Total Brain podcast series, hosted by Dr. Evian Gordon, founder and chief medical officer of Total Brain.
Today's podcast is on how emotions and feelings drive you. And I'm joined today by two colleagues and friends who are becoming a stalwart of the podcast, I'm delighted to say. Chris Darwin, who is Charles Darwin's great-great-grandson, and who is also a psychologist, a marketer, remarkable in many other ways that you will have heard on the other podcasts. And he also is the founder of the Darwin Challenge app to reduce meat eating that has been endorsed by Paul McCartney and Dr. David Whitehouse, Harvard-trained psychiatrist, MBA, theology, worked in the largest health insurance company in the United States, and is a consultant for many mental health projects across the land. Welcome to both of you again. It's a really interesting podcast topic today that was suggested by Chris, because he said, at a time in COVID where emotions are so hijacking the brain, it would be timely to try and unpack this more clearly in terms of the why, the what, and the how that emotions are really triggering that hijack, and how they relate to our feelings, decision making, rational thinking. And so Chris again has come up with another big picture, profound idea that we should focus on. Big surprise, Charles Darwin's great-great-grandson pushing us to keep focusing on the big picture, profound issues of our time. Who would have thought? Chris also, in our numerous emails, has written, I've long been a long-term a fan of the Total Brain podcast, and I've come to believe that we spend too much time on the what and not enough time on the why, and especially the how. So we'll try and do that as well, Chris. We'll try and focus on the how a little bit more. Thank you. Great idea. And so the essence of the podcast, those of you who are on the journey with us will know, is that we're trying to capture the essence. So the essence, in the same way as Chris's great-great-grandfather did with looking at the interconnection between all our species on the planet, that essence insight, or the same way in which Newton discovered, you know, the laws of gravity, basically, and the way that our planetary system works, how Einstein modified that slightly, or maybe a lot, and how quantum physics is beginning to really shape our further granularity, detail of the dynamics of all of that. In the brain, as you know, David Whitehouse and I, for example, have been focusing on the essence that the brain's primary organizing principle is safety first, and how stress, as a consequence of that, is the gateway to all mental health. And so it seemed that Chris's timing of this idea, this important next phase in this journey and in our overall insights as a total brain, embracing a total brain, the friend your brain approach, is to really dig deep on how does emotions and feelings drive our decision-making and our rational thinking, and why are emotions so prevalent, so easily able to hijack us? So let's begin with the why. Chris, maybe if you could start, why is this question so important to you?
Thanks. So where are we? I mean, dear listener, I'm on a journey like you are, I suspect, on the total brain, and it's already changing my life. I mean, obviously, I'm in front of the microphone, you're behind the speaker, but we're in the same position. So here we are. Evian's introducing us, and David as well, into a whole lot of concepts. 50,000 thoughts a day you're having. And most of those, I realized in my case, and I'd be interested for you to reflect on your case, most of those are emotional thoughts, and there is no gatekeeper. The emotions come up, 50,000 thoughts, and an action occurs. And that is sort of inevitable. But then listening to Evian in this podcast, I begin to realize that actually there is a second option. That's the normal option. That's the way I've been running my life for the last 60 years. But then I've been realizing that actually I need a gatekeeper. I look at those 50,000 ideas like 50,000 goats running through a gate. Every now and again, one of those goats is going to change your life. And it almost, you need to kind of grab it almost. You can't grab them all because there's so much going on. But every now and again, you've got to grab them. Now, I'm going to tell a story quickly about a goat I should have grabbed. A few years ago, my marriage wasn't going well. I started to get a bit down about it. And then I decided emotionally I was going to get a divorce. And I remember fronting my wife about that. I said, I'm going to get a divorce. I'm leaving. And fortunately, that was a goat that escaped. I should have grabbed that goat and I should have done an analysis. I should have thought about it logically. I should have asked some friends, but I didn't. I just, because I believed up until very recently that those people who think quickly look smart. The people who think slowly are slow and therefore they're stupid. So that was really lucky that in that case, my wife said, Chris, just slow it down a bit. Let's just try and work something out here. And she did conscious thinking. I was doing emotional thinking. Now, that could have really gone in so many different directions. And I think that if you think about your life, you know, dear listener, and we're going to probably talk about a few examples in this podcast just to lubricate your mind and just get you thinking of all the times you have thought emotionally about something and it has been disastrous in your life. We're going to encourage you on this podcast to give yourself a new tool on how to think, and that's conscious thinking. And what will you see change in your life? How will your life change? Well, that's a really good question. And I'd love to hear it really from Evian and David on this because they are the calm thinkers. I'm the emotional thinker in this game, but I'm hoping you're going, wow, this could really change my life because I think it could. How is that for the why, Evian?
That's great. Thank you so much, Chris. What about you, David? What is your why for emotions, feelings? How they hijack, could potentially hijack us, and how they affect our decision-making and actions.
Well, I think that I am just overwhelmed, both in kind of when I think about my own personal history, as well as from the journeys I've taken with patients, to realize how bereft we are in terms of actually understanding emotions at all in the first place. The number of patients that I've seen who've come finally for depression and who've started by saying, my family or somebody else thinks I'm depressed. It's not a label that they had chosen, and they've probably been depressed most of their life. And how do we actually give voice to our own emotional lives? We're actually quite poor at it. If you ask people, are you depressed? Are you sad? Are you frustrated? The nuances of language to dissect out minor variations are really hard for people. To the extent that in therapy, there are people who can say, I can't explain how I feel, but if you gave me a piano, these are musicians, I could play it for you. I know what it sounds like, but I can't tell you. And other people for whom colors, and I think about some of your paintings, Evian, and your whole artistic sense, and I've seen it in that, who said, I can paint it. If you give me color, I know how it comes out in color, but I don't have words and language. And yet therapy is all about language and how do you paint these pictures and so on. So for people who are tongue-tied, and then the other thing which I found fascinating was to find people who said, oh, I'm a very good read on emotions. You know, people say, I'm a good read. I know what people, other people are feeling. And then when you've actually done formal social emotional testing using recognition of facial expressions, they're absolutely awful. They score really low. They don't know the difference between anger, sadness, or disgust to save their life. And yet they're going around telling everybody they're a wonderful read on people.
And what is that, David? Is that just overconfidence or what is that?
I think we're really bad at both understanding our own emotions and actually recognizing other people's. So back to kind of the communication you had with your wife, which was spot on. you may have thought at that point you were having a moment of great insight. And she said, you've just been hijacked by your emotions, buddy. And it's not you talking. It's this emotion that's talking, and it's not you.
So, David, if I had rung you up on that day, I mean, here we are, the audience is probably thinking of all the emotional decisions they've made. If they had rung you up on that day, let's just say it's the same, what would you have encouraged them to do to try and transfer from an emotional way of thinking to a conscious way of thinking?
I would have said that there's probably a long history behind that. There are far more interesting things in marriages. I think over time, I've come to realize that one of the other things about emotions, the brain is lazy. And it has been said frequently that we tend to choose as life partners people who contain many of the faults and things that bothered us when we were growing up. Because instead of having to develop new ways of coping with things that irritate us, like nagging or whatever it is, we marry someone who can nag us again because we know the rules of nagging because we've grown up with it. So we choose them. And then what happens is we actually default to non-conscious listening. The minute we hear a tone, we respond to the tone of the voice, not the content, the argument, and we have stopped listening. And so, interestingly enough, I think our rather lazy brain, wanting to defend us, prefers to choose circumstances which repeat many of the problems we've had because it's easier. And I would have said to you, there's probably more going on than meets the eye, much of which you may not have fully understood. Maybe we need to reassess and look at the situation through a different lens.
Great context for us to explore a little more fully the what and the how. So that's a great context, David. Before we move on to the what, the why for me was there are lots of personal examples that we probably are not in the interest of time to get to the how. I will say one big issue that hit me, though, as I was going into the integrative journey on the brain, and that was, yes, the brain is about safety first, and we've discussed the stress implications of that. But the second thing and the purpose of today's podcast is that it really hit me like a lightning bolt that emotion cues are our first language and words and rational thinking are our second language. And that insight of the growing pieces across the landscape of the mind from neuroscience to psychotherapy and deep cognitive insights was shocking to me. Because as I got hijacked in having access to these insights about the brain, I still found myself impervious to being able to act on them. I could not believe that for someone in such a privileged situation of a science and medical background running a brain institute in the largest hospital in the Southern Hemisphere with input from so many key opinion leaders around the world that I could not stop myself from being so attuned to the mismatches that were hijacking me. I couldn't stop myself from developing a ledger of grudges of all my perceived mismatches every day and being fearful. Yeah, so I had here we were constructing the world's first standardized and integrated database. The feat of that was just horrendously complex and hard. Thank goodness the backer of the CEO of the hospital and the head of the Department of Psychiatry fully backed this. I was super empowered to do this. But as it started to happen, in addition to the most wonderful key opinion leaders and aligned people whose ideas were so magnanimously shared, we started to attract a lot of people, some people who were academic land grabbers, opportunists, people who just wanted to quickly make money from this. I was so shaken by the misalignments that I was attracting that every day became a kind of growing post-traumatic stress disorder of 3 a.m. early morning wakings of the misalignments. And I couldn't believe that I was being hijacked to this extent almost every day. Not to say that it wasn't the most incredible journey as well. So my example, Chris, in answer to your question, that I went through a depression, as you know. No one to blame. It was me, my inability to practice what I was preaching, my inability to stop building this ledger of grudges of what wasn't working. And last but not least, which took me a lifetime and still is a journey, to be present and to expand what is working and to learn from and have some humility about the fact that the real humility is just knowing the fallacy of being open to being wrong, to challenge that every day. How was I wrong? How was I deluding myself that I had the answers versus this being aware that this emotion, feeling, decision-making dynamic was just an incredibly powerful force.
Oh, sorry, Evan, can I ask you, so you were getting angry with your fellow workers, basically. Am I hearing that right? Because this could resonate with the audience as well.
Angry. I mean, not angry is worse than anger. Anger is easy. I don't get angry very easily. Thank you for asking that question, because here's what it was, why this was such a critical issue for me. It took me a while, Chris. I mean, I'm just trying to think of an analogy. It's sort of like what Eckhart Tolle and other people, that guy wrote the book on the journey of understanding that we are all faced with suffering and with challenges is the norm. And once we discover and accept that challenges are the norm, we immediately diminish the impact of those challenges. And it was more that when I realized that alignment, people who come with the right intentionality, that yes, of course, you now had the privileged position of seeing that most people are hugely self-serving. The brain is about safety and it's about getting what you want, and that everybody comes with their own vantage point. And it's very hard, same as in a relationship, to fully align, that that's the norm. And once you see that alignment is rare and you've got to work for it and you've got to really be open and sharing, including mistakes, it changed the dynamic. But until I landed on that point, Chris, that alignment is natural, being hijacked is part of life and is going to happen every day in many ways. And it was how we show up for it, how we deal with it. That's where the how becomes so critical. Until I landed on that, I was getting more and more depressed and literally getting into a kind of minor form of post-traumatic stress disorder, which lasted for years. Does that answer your question, Chris?
This is resonating with him or her. And I'm just thinking, what could you have done differently? Because what we're hearing is we're hearing something really normal, which is the lack of alignment, then the resulting emotions as a result of that. So you were in this incredibly lucky position, but there was everybody had different emotion, different reasons for being involved. So if you were to run the story back, how could you have stopped your emotions hijacking yourself to actually have got a better result for yourself?
Before we get onto the how and the how, it's a lot of that, Chris, is the what. When I really started to now as an integrationist, put it together both for the purpose of the mission, but also for the purposes of my own sanity, I began to realize that misalignment is the fundamental conundrum of ourselves, of the time, of the human species, that we are driven by these fifth of a second non-conscious shortcuts. And that is what emotions are. They are the shortcuts to pick up the cues that keep us safe and get us what we want. To me, it suddenly hit me. Initially, I used to call it a design flaw. Well, it's not a design flaw. It's actually incredibly efficient. And as David said, the brain is lazy. It's about efficiency. The brain is about efficiency, but it's mainly to keep safe. So I saw suddenly it began to hit me that these shortcuts were the biases These were our confirmation bias, our risk aversion bias. These were what made us efficient. And yes, they kind of distorted reality, but everybody has their own different distortions that they've been conditioned on. So when I saw that, Chris, that the brain had these shortcuts, emotions about cues, that happened in a fifth of a second, so it's automatic. And then at about half a second, you start feeling the impact of those shortcuts, those biases to get you what you want and to confirm in some cases where you need to be. And one other point, another shocking thing to me was that when I realized that most of the impact in communication, about 10% of it is what we actually say. About 40% is our tonality. And that blew my mind and so relevant to the COVID era and this podcast. And about 50% of it was our body language cues. So 10% the what, the content, 40% the tonality. Why? And 50% the body language. Because if our emotions are our first language, and if you look at evolutionary biology, it is. It's the cues. We didn't even have language initially. We grunted. And so we evolved this language over time. But the point is, if we're not attuned to that, and it's not just about emotions versus rational thinking, it's how do we align them? How do we get comfortable with them? What is authentic for us? How do we get a humility about our mistakes that we can make? I love your point about the gatekeeping. How do we start building a gatekeeping function that minimizes the derailing real time? So that's what started to shift for me, Chris. And that's what I would have done differently, is to not take it so personally, to be more present and aware of the fact that misalignments are a grist for the mill, and that just celebrate and have gratitude for when it is aligned and magnify what works. What do you do different with your knowledge about psychiatry in that regard?
So there are two things there which resonate from what you've just said. So one about the development of language and emotion as the first language, and totally, and when we look at the evolution of language, and it's in the same way as the evolution of the whole nervous system. So in the beginning, there is the reflex arc, message in, behavior out, input, external event. And then we develop a system that modifies that, that can slow the reflex so we don't do that. To the point in human beings that a human being is one of the only animals on the planet that can hold its hand in a flame and keep it there even when the flesh burns, which an animal cannot do because the reflex arcs is so powerful. The development of language was in part the ability to inhibit the pure world of emotional language, that we weren't just these primary process primates who were either aggressive and hit or cowering and retreated. And our behavior was totally based on our emotional language of how we viewed the situation. And we began to talk and we began to play. We began to practice emotions and behaviors and results and limited aggression and so on. And what I see in this is that we are so disconnected from our emotional world that we live at times, as you said, with 50% communication coming from the primary process of our emotions. And part of what gets us into trouble is our cognitive brain then fills in, imagines that we know the rest of the story. Because of its bias and because it wants to see in what goes on previous patterns, because it's easier than to think that there could be a multitude of new patterns. It doesn't want to process all the new information. We imagine that this feeling that we're getting comes from all the same places. And the one thing I would say was, when you were talking about those emotions, is that It was one of the things that you taught me when you began to show me what the testing showed on the ability to recognize emotions. That because in our early world, before we had even developed language or much of our thinking, it might be important in our world as a child to recognize anger because we lived in a household that was full of it. Whether it was an alcoholic parent, a drug abusing person, a violence in a global situation like Syria, we learned we had to know anger. And the problem with that is that our brain became exquisitely good at recognizing that emotion. And any tonal voice change, any facial expression change, any gesture change that might hint at anger, we became exquisitely sensitive at picking up. With the problem being that in a completely different environment, we would tend for the rest of our lives to overread neutral moves and always put into them perhaps the intention of anger for our own safety. So that as you found a world in which people were greedy and out for themselves and so on, the question is, how do you balance with how much of that is irritating because it is the genuine situation? And how much because you have been oversensitized to others? And in the therapist's position, it is generally that people who have become unhappy because in their emotional development, without realizing it, the biases have developed and may have been crucially adaptive at one point. But now, life has changed. When you even think about the discussions we're having currently about racial bias, how in a situation we know our own racial situations better because 95% of the people whose behaviors we watched looked and acted the same as us. We tend to not understand and feel more frightened by and anxious about people whose actions and behaviors we haven't witnessed. We don't feel as assured. So we carry these racial biases with us, and they are real because we haven't adapted to them. And integrated communities, it's far less. But when I think about all those things, they are part of a neurologic system that is continually trying to save and preserve us. But if never reflected upon, never tested or evaluated, I think to me, the one thing was, first of all, it was reliant initially on, in therapy, would you at least be interested in taking a look at it? Maybe by language we can talk about it and we'll gradually get to see the biases. Now, with neurologic testing and some of the things that you're aware of and have developed on Total Brain, you can actually perceive it in action. You can truly measure and track your biases. To me, that insight, to have a chance to become aware, oh my God, I see depression 2 standard deviations more frequently than everybody else. I never miss sadness in the world. I'll never miss it. And think then, what must that do to me every day? And I probably see it where it doesn't exist, but I assume that if it could be, maybe it should be hinted the color is over to gray or blue or whatever it is.
Such a great example, David, and such a good connection between what we do is measure on Total Brain, the non-conscious bias, and also the tools to actually train our awareness of emotion cues, also nudge our positivity through the positivity training tools. And then, of course, David, the many discussions and podcasts we've had with stress mastery control in the moment through tools like MyCombeat. Chris, Would you mind summarizing for us your pragmatic hows of the how are you going about putting up your gatekeeping? And they would apply equally for your gatekeeping as they would to the training people who want to train the emotion cues on Total Brain with the emotion cue training, or the positivity or the stress. What are the sort of takeaways you feel are most compelling in the how of the how to train this, to rewire our brain till it becomes automatic for this to happen?
Yeah, thank you. There's been so much gold has been given. Can I just quickly recap on a couple of things that I think the audience really could gain an awful lot from? So Evian said 10% of communication is about the words, 40% is about the tone. So I've learned from that on the how that we need to concentrate on our tone four times more than the words we use. Now, that is really important if I'm going to start communicating better. David just gave so much beautiful stuff in there on anger, on those biases. Now, I'm a negatively biased person. I tend to look for danger and oversee it. That has been really helpful for me, just thinking about those emotions. I tend to look for the negatives in people. It sounds like Evian was doing that a bit when you were talking about your life, you know, when you got a bit down. So that is the second thing, dear listener, I think you could get something from. So if you're trying to control your emotions, think about your tone a lot. And also just try and be really aware of your internal biases. Are you a glass half full or a glass half empty? If we're going to go now to how can we actually do this on a practical basis, just let's just say the audience has listened to this and goes, I'm going to change the way I can communicate. I'm very much like you, dear audience. I'm at the beginning. So I've got my first thing here, which is tone. I'm going to really watch my tone. Listen to David. His tone is just beautiful. It's calm. You listen to me, and I'm sure when I listen back to this, I can feel my hyperactive energy, which can feel aggressive and often is actually. The second thing I'm trying to do is I'm trying to do reflective listening. So when, for example, one of the people who works for me rung me up last week and said, I want to double my hourly rate. Now, that was a goat running at me, one of the 50,000 a day, and I could see it was big and black, and I went, I'm going to grab that goat before it gets out, and this could turn ugly. And I really didn't do it very well. And what I did think afterwards, because I got a bit angry with this whole concept that he was going to double his hourly wage, and I should have done reflective listening. I should have just gone, right, okay, so what you're saying is you want to double your hourly wage and you're doing a great job and blah, blah. And then while I was doing reflective listening, this is the third thing I've been determined to try and do, is try and think of options on how to respond. Have a think about options. So we've got three so far. Tone, which is Evian's. Doing reflective listening can buy you time to engage the conscious thinking as opposed to the emotional thinking. And thinking about options, I think, can also buy you time and encourage you to start thinking consciously. Those are three things that are jumping out at me. I mean, David, Evian, what else have you got on the how?
Well, that's beautiful. If you just could complete that a little, though, because I know you've also been researching the mechanics of how the wiring actually gets done. Could you give us your quick one-minute synopsis of BJ Fogg? Because he's just been brilliant in nailing this.
Yeah. So BJ Fogg, he's a Stanford University professor. He says, when you're going to change a behavior, do tiny steps. When I'm thinking about trying to become more conscious with my thinking, I'm trying to catch one go today. So I'm 50,000 thoughts. I'm only trying to catch one a day. The second thing is measure. And that is I'm measuring every day. I'm actually going to try and write stuff down. What was the goat I caught today of the 50,000 thoughts? What is the one I wrestled down? And the final thing is immediate reward and give yourself a pat on the back. So each time I actually do catch an emotional thought and try and turn it into a conscious decision-making process, I'm going to try and reward myself. I'm not quite sure how, but I'm interested. David, you got some ideas on this? How should I reward myself? I'm trying to stop the emotional, you know, trying to convert emotions into conscious thinking.
So actually, I think it relates to what Evan was saying about negativities. I do ask my patients, because of the 5-to-1 ratio of remembering all the bad things that happened to the day and the good things, is to try and write down every day the good things. And then I tell them, you have to write them down in excruciating detail, because the interesting thing is, when we think about the good things, we don't notice them. I'll just give an example of that. So if I say to somebody, oh, well, here's my example. When I ask you about a good thing, I don't mean something ecstatic, 8 out of 10. I mean something that's like a 3 out of 10. I mean, like if the sun was shining in the afternoon, and they kind of get it. And they say, oh, yeah, all right, I got it. And then you say, no, I mean, how did you know the sun was shining? I said, was there shadows across your desk? Was the sky blue? Was it blue gray? Were there clouds in it? Oh, that, which way were the clouds going? Were they going left or right? And then I ask them to say, I guarantee you when good things happen, you don't notice them in detail. You have excruciating detail of everything that went wrong. And you will ruminate about that all night when you're trying to go to sleep. But of the good thing that happened. And so I would say in your BJ fog moment, in that little nudge, your reward should be to go back to the moment and remember your small victory, but remember it in excruciating detail. And in remembering it in excruciating detail, you will sow two seeds. One, your brain will come back to it at other times, saying, oh, we liked that. We'll do more of that. And it will help you in terms of total negativity to have found something that was a success, the beginning of a new path, that you have the power to make a difference to the way you're going to live your life going forward.
Beautiful, David. I knew you'd say something good. Excruciating detail. I love that. And writing it down. So, David, what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to try and write down every day the one goat I caught that day in excruciating detail. That's beautiful. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely. So, gents, as always, time has been our enemy, but it's been wonderful. And, Chris, I hope we've done justice to capture some of the better flow. I wonder if you wouldn't mind, Chris, suggesting our three takeaways, but you've both been absolutely marvelous in helping shape what I believe will be many more podcasts to come about this very fundamental issue. Your thoughts, Chris?
Okay, so we had a chat at the beginning about this, and David, I think you've got a feeling for David now. He is a beautiful, measured, considerate, compassionate individual. He said, know yourself, and I love that. So just be compassionate towards yourself. Understand who you are, and don't be too tough on yourself. I love that. Evian said, be present. And I think that is really important, because I don't know, dear listener, if you're a bit like me, I live in the future and I live in the past. I often don't live in the present because I'm ruminating about the past. I'm planning for the future and sometimes fearful of the future. So just to try and be present, actually be here when you're communicating with somebody. Now, and my one was tiny steps. And this is the BJ Fogg thing, which I think just makes it great. If you decide on January the 1st, you're never going to drink alcohol again in your life, the chances of being successful are basically zero. If you decide on January the 1st, so I'm going to have one day a week when I don't drink any alcohol, the chances of being successful are actually quite high because you took a tiny step. So tiny steps is mine. I hope this has been helpful for you. And maybe we should do a follow-up one. I'm going to be writing down excruciating detail of notes as a result of David's help. And we'll see whether we can make the world a better place. Love to all.
Thank you so much to both of you and to everybody who's listened. Thank you very much. See you next time.